He's excited about RNA. I think you all know what RNA is. If you don't, she will tell you. And because we now know that it is not inert, and it carries out the function of both DNA and proteins. So RNA is quite flexible. And experts are now focusing less on DNA and proteins, but on an RNA hypothesis known as RNA world hypothesis. And she deemed herself to be an explorer at heart.
Yes.
So,
yep.
Welcome her.
So,
oh, you're wired.
They wired me.
Is it working?
I think it's working,
okay.
Yeah. So I'm glad to see all of you again. I want to be truthful, so my bachelor's degree is not in computer science. That was a misprint they gave you. My bachelor's degree was in biology and chemistry, but I am cross-trained in computer science, and I have the equivalent of a bachelor's degree in computer science. So, anyway.
Can I say one more thing? He's got a lot of information to give today. Listen carefully. Hold your questions till
yeah.
the end.
I won't take any questions during the presentation because yeah. we've lost too much time. So, I have someone's coffee here. So, I have a lot of information to talk about today. And you notice I titled my presentation, A Skunk by Any Other Name. And in case you don't recognize the quote, it's really a takeoff on Shakespeare when he said a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. Well, in this case, a skunk by any other name would still smell really bad. And there are there's a lot of information about evolution that smells very fishy if you actually know any science. And so we'll be talking about some of that today. So we're going to be focusing on parts of the theory of evolution that don't jive with the latest research. Okay. Okay, so the first question is, I want to talk about whether or not evolution is even science, then five types of evolution, and the limits. There's some non-controversial types of evolution that everyone, all creationists, agree with evolutionists that certain types of evolution do occur, and those are non-controversial, but they're very limited. And then there are controversial types of evolution, and we'll talk about data that contradicts those types of evolution. Among those examples of conflicting data are the origin of life problem, the problem of the Cambrian explosion, the phylogenetic tree problem, the convergence problem, and the accelerated evolution problem. Now, this is just a subset of some of the types of data that conflict. We can't get through all. I mean, there's a lot of things that don't make sense. Okay, first of all, is evolution science? And what I'm showing here is a view of the evolutionary tree that was proposed a long time ago. It's around the era of Darwin that they first put up these kinds of evolutionary trees, which supposedly show all of life originating from a single organism down here. So what does something have to be like to be science? Science is a process by which you observe things, you form hypotheses to explain what you're observing, then you devise experiments to test what you've hypothesized, and then based on the results of the test, you either need to confirm your hypothesis or falsify it, deem that your hypothesis is incorrect. If your hypothesis was proven by the experiments to be incorrect, when you go back and if you want to just revise your hypothesis, you have to have a rational explanation of why you were wrong and why you can now put forth an altered hypothesis. You can't just say, oh, well, the data shows I'm wrong, so let's just change that part of my hypothesis. You have to be able to explain what about your hypothesis led you to this wrong prediction from your hypothesis, because what you're really testing is generally not the entire hypothesis. You test individual predictions that come from your hypothesis. And so the question is the theory of evolution falsifiable? That is, are there experiments that can be done that can indicate that the hypothesis is an error? And the answer to that is yes, there are experiments that can be done. And in fact, a lot of experiments are done that contradict the theory of evolution. But is it ever falsified in the scientific literature? No. Because what happens is The scientists who collect data that contradicts the theory of evolution either explain away their data, or they make a change to the theory of evolution without explaining why they are justified in making that change instead of rejecting the theory of evolution. So there's no rationale for how they adopt the theory, adapt it to the latest data. They just do. And so we'll see examples of that. And one of the indicators that evolution is not science, is at least in our world today, it's not science, is that evolutionists intensely oppose the teaching of critical thinking skills in science when it comes to the theory of evolution. They've had a battle in Texas just recently. They had testimony before the boards in Texas, where they these are the boards that create the textbooks. Texas buys so many textbooks that generally the standards set in Texas end up applying to the whole nation. They buy that many textbooks compared to the rest of the nation. And so so whatever is decided in Texas that textbooks should contain, that's what goes for the whole United States. So it's a big battle in Texas over what goes into the textbooks. And one of the things that creationists wanted to have in the textbooks was information on the scientific method and learning how to critique ideas using the scientific method. And they wanted to include in the textbooks some of the problems with the theory of evolution. Evolutionists were adamantly opposed to using critical thinking skills to critique the theory of evolution. They fought it. It's in the quotes that they delivered. Of course, their rationale is that, well, creationists will just use it to get their ideas in, so we don't want any critiquing of the theory of evolution. But that still makes it non-science. If you can't critique it, then it's non-science. And sometimes we wonder, where do our young people get so many weird ideas? Well, one of the problems is they're not being taught critical thinking skills in schools nearly enough. And so if you're not taught critical thinking skills, then you're subject to any lie at all. You don't know how to discern what's false and what's true. So even though it should be a situation where you could falsify the theory of evolution, it doesn't happen. It doesn't happen nowadays. And you can't critique the theory of evolution without being called an idiot. And as you guys know from dealing with Hugh, you know, anyone who believes in creation or doesn't believe in the theory of evolution is considered to be backwards. So when they refer to someone as being backwards, that's an ad hominem attack. They're attacking the person rather than their beliefs. You know, they just call you an idiot and be done with it. Okay, so let's talk about what is evolution. We all know that it involves changes in living organisms, but actually it's broader than that, and so I've divided up here, and this isn't my original division. Fuzz Rana, our other biochemist, came up with this, and it's excellent, so I'm borrowing it. We're using it throughout the RTB organization. So some types of evolution are not controversial. The first three types, microbial evolution, microevolution, and speciation, are not controversial. And by the way, I can generate a PDF file from this and send it to someone in the class from these slides, so that you can have all of these details if you'd like. Okay, you can distribute it by email. So microbial evolution is not controversial. It involves changes in viruses, bacteria, archaea, and single-cell eukaryotes. So all the single-cell type organisms, and even some that are small colonies, but they're not a real sophisticated organism where you have different organ systems, nothing like that. More along the level of just single cells and colonies of essentially single cells that are cooperating together. That's not controversial. An example of it is acquisition of antibiotic resistance in bacteria. We all know that happens. And when you hear evolutionists say, you see evolution happening all around you, they're referring to things like microbial evolution, or they're referring to microevolution, and sometimes they're even referring to speciation. So microevolution refers to changes happening within a species that are more along the lines of adaptation. So it's within the species. The species doesn't change to another species. There's just a different characteristic within the species. And an example of that is the color changes in the wings of peppered moths, and we're going to go over a slide and talk about this in detail. The third one is speciation. It occurs when one species gives rise to a closely related sister species. An example of this is the evolution of the finches on the Galapagos Islands from one ancestral finch species that came to this archipelago from South America. Galapagos is a group of islands called an archipelago just off of South America. And, you know, Darwin went there, visited there during his voyage, and a lot of what he saw there fed into his theory of evolution. So we'll have a slide to talk about this one as well. Now, the controversial types of evolution, first of all, is chemical evolution. That's the belief that life came from non-life, that chemicals somehow gradually increased in sophistication and required characteristics that we think of as belonging to living organisms. For example, the ability to reproduce themselves, to make another copy of themselves. And gradually that proceeded on and on until you had a simple cell. That's the idea of the chemical origin of life. It's not life from life, it's life from non-life. Then macroevolution, and that's a proposed theory that says that evolutionary processes have real creative potential, where you can go from an ape to a human. You can go from a wolf-like animal to a whale. Because right now the theory of evolution is proposing that, in fact, whales did come from a wolf-like mammal. Okay, so those are the types of evolution. And the first three are non-controversial. We'll go over examples of them. The controversy begins with these two, and we'll spend more time on these two. Now, again, when evolutionists say you can see evolution happening all around you, you can't possibly deny it, they're talking about the first three, and generally they're talking primarily about the first two. And so I'll show you examples of those, and that's really about adapting to your environment. And we have a God that enabled all of us and other animal species to adapt to their environment. Otherwise, as soon as their environment changed, they would all die off. And obviously, he didn't want his creation constantly dying off. There were times when he allowed portions of his creation to die off and recreated new life forms to replace them when there was a dramatic change in the climate, for example. But he gave species the ability to adapt within a certain range of conditions surrounding them. And these three types that are non-controversial show that ability to adapt. Okay. But these non-controversial types of evolution have very limited ability to provide change. The changes you see are not big. They don't explain things like going from a chimp to a human. And we'll see that as we look at each of them in detail. There was a long-term experiment that was done in, I think it was done in Michigan. And if you want to read about it on the internet, all you have to do is Google long-term evolution experiment. And in this experiment, scientists at this university took a single culture of bacteria, and bacteria divide asexually. They don't mate generally. They just make copies of their DNA, copies of their organelles, copies of the molecules that they use, and then split into two separate cells, so all the cells are identical. So what you usually do is you have a petri dish with individual colonies that you can see as separate dots. And each dot represents a pure clone of the bacteria, because each of the dots grew from a single bacteria. That's how that culturing works. And so you take a single colony and then you put it into a large flask. The flask was shown above in a liquid medium. Now it's in a liquid growth medium. And all the bacteria that grow from that original colony should all have identical DNA. They should be clones of one another because of the way E. coli reproduce. Occasionally you will find mutations when this occurs, and you can get different characteristics of the bacteria that go through this process. And in this particular experiment, they wanted to mimic long-term evolution and see what they could get from long-term evolutionary processes. So they actually grew up to 50,000 generations of E. coli, starting with a single colony, and they separated them. They separated them as soon as they had gotten the first colony. They grew it up in a small amount, then separated it into 12 different flasks and let them grow up independently from one another. So as they grew, they would use up all the nutrients, and then you would take some of them and you would put them into fresh medium and freeze part of what you put away. But you keep the 12 flasks separate from one another. So you had 12 independent lines growing that all had the exact same ancestor. And they did this for 50,000 generations, which isn't hard to do because bacteria only take about 20 minutes to divide, to reproduce. So their growth is very fast. I've put on many cultures of bacteria from a single colony, put them on to grow overnight in a shaker where the fluid gets lots of oxygen because of the shaking, and it's warm to an appropriate temperature for them. You come back the next day and you have this, you start with this clear golden amber liquid. You come back and it's all cloudy. That's all the bacteria in it. And you have to be careful, in fact, to come back soon enough, because if you go too long, they'll run out of nutrients and they'll start dying off. They grow really fast. They have an exponential growth curve. Okay, so what did they actually observe under those 50,000 generations? They did see some evolutionary adaptation, which is to be expected. They purposely grew these in a culture medium that didn't have a richness of all the ingredients that E. coli needed. They did that to put pressure, evolutionary pressure on them, which is, you know, the kind of thing that evolutionists say drives mutations and changes, is having conditions under which the organism has to adapt. So they put them into a nutrient-poor culture. There was enough nutrients for them to survive, but not to be real hardy. And by doing that, you force them to, quote-unquote, evolve by stressing them. And so they did see some adaptations that occurred in more than one of the flasks. They saw the same mutation occurring in more than one of the flasks. And when that happens, that's called convergence. That means different organisms coming to the same solution, when, in fact, evolution is supposed to be a random process and random mutations, and you shouldn't get repeated evolution. That was part of the theory of evolution until recently. This is where they've changed the theory, because convergence is being observed so much that they had to admit that it occurs. But they didn't change the definition of how evolution occurs. But you need to, because if it's a random event, how can you keep getting the same result over and over again? And so there's no explanation except that they just say, well, of course convergence occurs. So that's what I mean by you can't falsify the theory of evolution. So they did see some of the changes in multiple flasks, others only in single populations. And according to the theory of evolution, you should have an even rate of evolution, okay? Even rate of mutations. Mutations are not supposed to occur in big bursts followed by lulls, but in fact that is what they observed. You know, when they first put it into this medium, there was a big burst, and then after that, a big burst of mutations, and then once they had achieved a set of mutations that allowed them to do a little better in this liquid, they stopped mutating very much. They just didn't have very many mutations, and that's not supposed to be true. That also contradicts the theory of evolution, but you know, nothing has been done to change it. Okay, the scientists estimated that only 10 to 20 beneficial mutations achieve fixation, which means it was a good enough mutation that all of the bacteria in that flask adopted that same mutation. They all had the same mutation. Okay, 50,000 generations and only 10 to 20 beneficial? That's not a big change. There were a number of negative mutations that were also found to occur in more than one population. I think four of the flasks developed the inability to correct DNA errors. When they were making copies of DNA, they couldn't fix any errors. They found less than 100 total point mutations that reached fixation in each of the flasks. Less than 100 total mutations. You have to have a pretty high rate of mutation to do things, to accomplish things like getting from a chimp to a human. And so, you know, you're not getting these massive amounts of mutation you're supposed to get. The final population of E. coli that they finished up with was less hardy than the starting strain. That's also is kind of a problem, because evolution is supposed to correct the problems and make you hardier than you were before. But in fact, these populations were less hardy, and as soon as you reintroduced into the flask the regular nutrients that E. coli needs, they lost, quote unquote, lost a lot of the beneficial mutations that allowed them to live in the poor nutrient medium. And the reason is because, unlike us, bacteria have an ability to revert to other things, and so they tend to revert to the original strain. And once one bacteria in the mixture attains reversion, it so outcompetes the others, because the original biochemistry of E. coli was so well adapted to its environment that the one that reverts back to the original strain outcompetes all the others, and it takes over everything. Okay, so what does it tell you about what they're really observing here? They're observing adaptation, okay? This is just adapting to your circumstances. They find convergence, where you get the same events repeated in multiple flasks, even though they're independent experiments, and there's no reason why they should come up with the same set of mutations that give them certain properties, but they did. And this is non-directional evolution. And what I mean by that is it's not leading to something new that is hardy and viable. Instead, it leads to a fragile organism that, as soon as it's given different circumstances, it reverts to the old genetic code, because that old genetic code was so much better. It was a well-suited bacteria for the environment. It's well-suited. And we also see this throughout our world. We see many, many species that haven't changed in hundreds and thousands of years. They aren't, quote-unquote, evolving. So you have to actually force species into environments that will cause them to go through this process of evolution, but you don't really see directional evolution when you look at microbial evolution. Okay, here's another type of non-controversial evolution called this is called microevolution. This is where you get changes within a species. And the classic example of this is the peppered moth. And originally, peppered moths looked like this. They were pale colored. And they typically rest on the lichen on trees. And when they're against the lichen on trees, they're camouflaged, and birds can't see them and eat them. But during the Industrial Revolution in Great Britain and Scotland, the trees tended to lose their lichen. It was killed off. The trees had soot on them. It was very, before air pollution laws, the trees became dark, and the peppered moths were very susceptible to being seen in their white version against a dark tree. So they adapted to the Industrial Revolution by developing a dark color. You see that the name of the species stays the same, but they use the word morpha, and the typica means the white-bodied, and the Morpha carbonaria is the dark-colored one. Okay, so they developed this to give them camouflage. However, as soon as air pollution laws kicked in and the lichen returned, they reverted back to the white color. It wasn't a permanent change. It's not directional evolution. They're adapting, and generally speaking, when a species adapts, the form that they go towards is generally has inferior biochemistry, and they like to revert to their original form because that's the form that's the most hardy. And so you have this occurring here. So this is an example of microevolution. The third kind of evolution we're going to talk about that's non-controversial is speciation. And this is when you have very closely related species coming from one another because of pressure in the environment that causes them to adapt in different ways. And these are the Galapagos finches. There's examples of four of them. These three all belong to the same genus and a different species. This one has a different genus, G-E-N-U-S, genus. But what you really see among these three is that the beak size changed depending on the weather conditions, because they tend to eat hard seeds. And when it gets real dry, the seeds are tough. Food is less abundant. They have to be able to break these tough seeds open to eat what's inside of them. And so So their big rigidity changes in size, changes depending on the weather conditions. And so as they watch these birds over a longer period of time, so you can get some speciation where you can get a different species of the same kind of bird, and the big difference will be around beak size and beak shape and things related to the beak. But if you can eat, you can also observe among these species, you don't lose your species, but even among a single species like this, you can see its beak size varying around a median beak size, depending on the weather conditions. And then once the weather stabilizes, they go back to their traditional beak size, their standard beak size. And so they're just varying around a norm. Yes, over time, some of them differentiate enough to form different species, but it's not, it's only adaptation, it's a variation around a mean, and when within the species, they can change beak type and revert back when the weather returns to a normal condition. There's no real directional evolution here either. Okay, so you're not making big, real changes. So when someone says evolution happens all around you, you can see it everywhere, you need to explain to them that what can be seen is non-controversial types of evolution. Mainly, it's really a form of adaptation is what you're seeing that occurs over and over again. Okay. Now, let's go on to some of the controversial aspects of evolution. Chemical evolution is probably the most controversial, and this is the one where if you talk to an evolutionist, they won't want to talk about chemical evolution. They'll say, let's just talk about evolution, let's not talk about the origin of life. If they're knowledgeable, that's what they'll say. Let's not talk about the origin of life. Let's just talk about species changing once life came into existence. The reason they don't want to talk about it, there's no theory for it. They can't find, even in a laboratory where they control the conditions, they can't find any plausible scenarios that have any real relationship to what scientists thought the environment was like at the time. They can't find experimental conditions to generate the molecules they need to generate. So they don't want to talk about it because the best experiments in this area are highly flawed. And we're going to go over an example of a recent best case scenario. It's an experiment that was highly lauded in the literature because it's progress from their point of view, but it's really not, it's not plausible. It's just not plausible, and I'll show you why. Okay, so almost every biology textbook that you open will contain this experiment, the Miller-Urey experiment, and they'll describe it to you, and they'll talk about how amino acids were created, which are the building blocks of proteins, were created in a laboratory setting, and how wonderful this is, and this just demonstrates that life can be created, blah, 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 blah. What they don't tell you is that this experiment is irrelevant. And the reason it's irrelevant is because at the time this experiment was done in the 1950s, they believed that the conditions on the early Earth were such that we had methane, ammonia, hydrogen, and no oxygen. Now we realize the conditions on the early Earth were carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and water vapor. That was the atmospheric conditions. You can't get the kinds of prebiotic materials in this kind of an experiment. You can't get them using these ingredients. Okay, you can't get the prebiotics. So when someone talks about prebiotic soup, you need to realize there was no prebiotic soup. There's no evidence for a prebiotic soup. No one can figure out methods to get to a prebiotic soup. No one can give you reactions to get to one that are realistic for the conditions on the early Earth. Okay, so this experiment is in every biology textbook that I know of except for Christian ones. And they don't acknowledge the problems in the experiment. It's presented as if it were reliable. And it's not. But at the time this experiment occurred, origin of life biologists said, we are this close to demonstrating the chemical origin of life. We'll have it solved in no time. That's in the 1950s. It's been all downhill ever since. It's just an intractable problem. Okay. Here's another problem related to the origin of life, and this is the chirality problem. And you've probably heard Hugh talk about this. Chirality in molecules means that in most organic molecules, the ones that are important for life, They have molecules can be in one of two forms. They can be mirror images of one another, as you see in this diagram. This is the same molecule, and one is an L form and one's an R form of the molecule. And what that means is in three-dimensional space, remember molecules are not flat. In three-dimensional space, the groups around the carbon are oriented in different directions. They point in different directions. Here, the R group points toward this, well, this one points toward the center. But you can see that these are mirror images of one another, like your hands are mirror images of one another. You can't put your hands on top of each other like this. Okay, you can't get them to work. Ooh, too close to that. Okay. Okay, so these non-superimposable molecules are critical for living systems. Throughout living systems, you have only one of the two types occurring. Okay? You will have either the L form occurring exclusively or the R form or the D form occurring exclusively. You don't get both. DNA and RNA require what are called the D version of the sugars, and it just talks about which way the atoms point in space. They require D sugars. Proteins require L amino acids. You cannot, a biochemical system will not accept an L sugar. I'm getting the L and the R in there because there's two different versions, schemes for naming these. One is the D and L, the other is the L and the R system. And I'm trying to use the D and the L, but I get confused. Okay, so biological systems can only use one version of a chiral molecule, strictly. They cannot use the other version. It's impossible. Yet, we know of no system outside of biochemical systems that can create a pure source of only the D form of something or the L form of something. So if you go back to this chemical origin of life problem, you not only have to create these molecules, which they don't have any pathway to create, but when you create them, they must be in an absolutely pure form, only one type. Okay, but biological systems are the only thing we know of that can create pure forms, because biological systems use enzymes to conduct their reactions. The enzymes are like a glove, and you know, you can fit the ball into the glove, but they're three-dimensional like gloves, and you have to fit to them, and so they can specifically only allow one shaped molecule to fit into them, and they generate as their output only one form, either the D or the L. They don't generate both. But if you take a regular experiment in the lab with no biological molecules involved and run an experiment to create a molecule that you would typically see in a living system, you get a mixture. You'll get half D and half L. And you can't have that. You can't have that in any system that's going to lead to life. And I'll give you an example of why you can't have that in any system that leads to life in the next topic we talk about. I'll give you a specific example of that. Okay. So what we're going to do now is go over a study that was published in 2007 in the journal Nature. I mean, 2009 in the journal Nature. This was considered to be a great breakthrough because in the lab, they have had extraordinary difficulty in trying to create the C and the U residues that occur in DNA. You know, we've talked about the four bases in DNA, which are A, C, G, and T. They haven't been able to create the C's and the T's. If it's an RNA, it's a C and a U. They haven't been able to create these in the lab through any protocol that they've devised that resembles early Earth conditions. They can't do it. And in 2009, a study was published that has better success than anything so far, but it's really terrible, and I'll show you why. And yet it wasn't critiqued in the literature. It wasn't critiqued. All the problems in this weren't critiqued. Okay. The first issue with this is that it has very low yield. So you're trying to get over to, this is the basis of a C, a T, or a U that you would use to build DNA or RNA. And remember, the most prominent origin of life hypothesis is an RNA world hypothesis, where the first molecule built was RNA. It was the first molecule with biological type activity. So we're trying to get to C and U because we're talking about RNA. And you need these units. These are the units that This is either a CRU, consider this to be a CRU, and you use them to build up chains of RNA, long chains of RNA. Okay, so these scientists did devise a method to get to this product, the C or the U, but there are a lot of problems in the experiment. The first issue is that you get extremely low yields. Okay, the yield at the first step is good. Yield here is pretty good, but the yield at step two and down in step four is very low. And this is the yield for the individual reaction. But the yield for the overall process, for this entire process that you have to go through, is a product of each of the individual yields. And you can see up in the corner that I multiplied the individual yields. And so you get an overall yield of 3.3%. That's incredibly small. So you have to remember that this is only one of the building blocks that goes into RNA. You need to continue adding on other U's, other A's, other G's, and this has to keep happening. And so you need a lot of these. And getting a lot of these very fast is very important. And you'll see that as we go through the future slides. There's actually seven issues that I'd like to bring out with, that are problems in this experiment. And as we go through them, you'll see why you need a lot of them very fast. Okay. Okay. A second issue is that the early Earth atmosphere containing carbon dioxide, nitrogen, and water doesn't generate the compounds that they use in this experiment. Okay, so you can see, I mean, and this isn't critiqued in the scientific literature. I'm reading this and going, what is going on here? You see this compound that they use as a starting one, that one up at the top, the other one over there by the nine? Those aren't available. Nobody knows where they would come from. Okay, there's no ready source for them. You can find trace amounts of these in things like asteroids, but there's not a lot of them. We can't find a lot of them. We can't find all of them. They're not, like I said, these are the things that would make up your prebiotic soup, these precursors. There is no prebiotic soup. No one can provide a mechanism for generating this prebiotic soup. Okay, so the third issue is that there are many byproducts in this. This is, if any of you have ever taken organic chemistry lab, you know what I'm talking about. This is because there are no enzymes involved here. These are not living systems. These are just chemical systems in a flask, and they don't have the ability to produce pure products the way biological systems do. If we go back here to this slide, step two here, where you go to this final product, there, that has the 12 underneath it, that process generates not just that molecule that's labeled 12, but it generates a lot of other molecules that you don't want. These, all of these molecules. Okay, now it's not immediately evident to you why you don't want them, because they all look very similar to what you got in step two, the desired product. But part of the reason why they look similar but aren't is because of the three-dimensional orientation in space. The chirality of them isn't right. But none of these are the right products. And look at the high quantities that they're found in. Okay, so you get all these contaminants in that, in here. And these contaminants are active compounds. And so they're going to keep reacting with other things in your mixture. Okay? So they interfere with the other reactions. Okay. Now, not only that, but a lot of intelligent intervention was required. If anything argues for an intelligent designer, this experiment does. Okay? I mean, it begs for an intelligent designer. These are the conditions that they ran this experiment in. Okay, notice that you start in a solution, then you go to a dry reaction, then you go to something other than water to have this reaction, and it's an organic chemical called formamide. Okay? You have a pH of 7, which is, I mean, think of that. You're in a non-living setting, and you're supposed to attain the perfect balanced pH of 7.0. Okay? That's not something that occurs without some work. You know, our pools, we have to adjust the pH of our pools to get it right. You don't get to 7, pH of 7, without some intervention. Then it goes to 6.5, and then in these other solutions, the pH is not valid because this is dry and this is formamide and it doesn't have a pH. Okay, now your temperature. You start off with 60 degrees Celsius, then you go to 40, then to 23. Then here you have to use two different temperatures and then up to 100 down here. Okay, the time. Look at the different times that are required. 2 days. These reactions need to be occurring fast. Of course, if this was occurring in a living system, this kind of a reaction would be going so fast that you couldn't even film it. It would go so fast. And notice that this one's first in a closed vesicle, then you have to reduce the pressure. How are you going to get that in a warm little pond, as Darwin described? You know, it just doesn't happen. And then again, I showed the yields on the side here. Okay, so this required humans doing all of these things, adjusting it all the time. But it's supposed to occur in a warm little pond. It's not possible. Again, it argues for an intelligent designer. Okay, now another issue 5, is that the phosphorus concentration here is unrealistic for early Earth. That's a very high concentration of phosphate. Phosphate tends to form insoluble compounds. That means it tends to react with other things, and when it does, it becomes a solid. And it needs to be suspended here in water, dissolved in water, for this reaction. And that's not the form you find it in. That's not what geologists think the form of phosphate was on the early Earth, and it wasn't in high concentrations. So that's a problem for this reaction. Okay. Okay, let's talk about activated ribonucleotides. This product here is called an activated ribonucleotide. You call it a ribonucleotide because it's a unit that belongs to RNA, and that R in RNA stands for ribo. Okay, so this is a ribonucleotide, and it's activated because of this phosphorus group here. This phosphorus group here is extremely reactive, highly reactive compound. And it's going to react with the first thing that it can possibly react with. So what about all those contaminants from step 2? It can react with one of those. This is supposed to be building into a chain of RNA, but instead it can react with anything around it. And when you take that activated ribonucleotide that's supposed to be forming this chain of RNA, as soon as it reacts with something else, then the chain that you've been building, if you just are in the process of attaching, if you have an activated ribonucleotide, like we saw from the last slide here, let me go back. If we have an activated ribonucleotide and it reacts from something from step 2, then whatever compound that forms can add to your RNA chain. This is your RNA chain that you're supposed to be building. If it adds that improper chemical to your, as the next unit in your RNA, that RNA is useless. It's done. Okay? So the idea that this experimental process gives you any reasonable path to get to an RNA molecule is really laughable. It's not critical thinking. And yet you can't find a critique of this because the problem of finding a way to create the C and the U units is so bad that even something this poor in yield and in quality is deemed to be wonderful. It's so critical to the evolutionary hypothesis, and it's so difficult that anything that accomplishes anything is taken as a wonderful thing. Okay? So that's, and again, you know, you talk to anybody who really knows evolution, they don't want to talk to you about the origin of life. It's not what they want to talk about. Okay. So let's go on to another problem that is exemplified in macroevolution. So the two big areas of evolution that are controversial, the origin of life, that is chemical evolution, and then the next one is macroevolution. It's where you have real creative changes, for example, going from a chimp to a human. Okay. Some of the data that is a problem for the theory of evolution and has been ever since Darwin conceived of it is the Cambrian explosion. The Cambrian explosion occurred about 530 million years ago, and what it was is that you had the sudden appearance of sophisticated life forms. In fact, you see the appearance of life forms that belong to all the major categories of life we see today. Now, you didn't have humans or anything like that yet, but we belong to the category vertebrates and the phyla vertebrates, and you see vertebrates appearing here during the Cambrian explosion. The problem is they seem to come from nowhere. Prior to the Cambrian explosion, all you had were single-cell organisms, and you had colonies But that's all. You know, a cluster of bacterial cells that might have been operated together, or fungi or algae or something. But you don't see any sophisticated organs with division of labor between different organ systems. Nothing like that. Just out of the blue, there it is. All these species. Charles Darwin knew about the Cambrian explosion. Fossils related to the Cambrian explosion had already been discovered at that time. And he saw it as one of the major problems in his theory, evidence against his theory. And you can find that on The Origin of Species by Natural Selection, his book, page 315 and 316, where he talks about it. I'm sure it depends on which edited version, which what publisher it comes from, as to what pages you find it on. But one of the ways that evolutionists had tried to argue around this is to say that prior to the Cambrian, there were multicellular organisms around, but they were just too fragile or too small to be seen. And prior to the finding of a large area of Cambrian deposits in China, that might have been a reasonable argument, or a somewhat reasonable argument, because they couldn't see anything below the Cambrian. You know, it's just like, because there were no sophisticated organisms or complex organisms before the Cambrian, when you look in the rocks, you get below the Cambrian and then there's nothing. There's, you know, if you might find some single cell organism fossils, but nothing else. But in China, in the Cambrian deposits that they found there, the layers underneath the Cambrian were healthy enough, the preservation was healthy enough, that they were able to find the embryos of things like jellyfish. One of the only kinds of multicellular organisms around were the embryos of jellyfish. They were microscopic and they were soft bodies. It's very hard to preserve anything that's microscopic and soft body. So if there is anything other than jellyfish around before the Cambrian, you should see them in this layer that they see in China. But you don't. You don't see anything but the jellyfish embryos and other things like that. You don't see any real sophisticated organisms. You don't see most of the major phyla represented. Those phyla just, boom, come into existence in a short period of time in the Cambrian. So this is a major problem for the theory of evolution. There's still no explanation for it. Right now they're working on theories that the genes that would allow you to develop a multicellular organism were already present. They just weren't being used. But, you know, there's a problem with that, too. You have to do some fancy manipulations with your data mathematically to reach that conclusion. Okay. Here's a very specific example of the kind of sudden explosion of sophisticated organisms that you see in the Cambrian that's such a problem for evolutionists. And in fact, this case in particular, the case of eyes, was an issue for Darwin. Darwin considered that eyes were essentially a perfect organ. He was amazed by them, and he said that the evolution of eyes would have had to occur over a long period of time in very gradual steps, starting with a very primitive eye and going forward from there. In fact, just recently, prior to like a month ago, we didn't know of very sophisticated eyes in organisms in the early part of the Cambrian. We saw eyes in there's an organism that you always hear about when you think of the Cambrian explosion, trilobites. Trilobites had relatively simple eyes, and they fit in okay with the evolutionary theory. And as the Cambrian proceeded on, you began to see more and more sophisticated types of eyes. But then, just about a month ago, a new study was published in which they found these fossil imprints of compound eyes in an arthropod that occurred very early in the Cambrian explosion. No explanation for this. This should not happen according to the theory of evolution. These are eyes as sophisticated as many modern arthropods have today. I did a podcast on these recently, and so a Science News Flash. So if you'd like to hear that, you can go listen to the Science News Flash on our website, reasons.org, and listen all about this particular topic. I'm not going to give too many more details because we're so short on time. Okay. Another problem is, another example of the problems in macroevolution is the idea that humans descended from chimps. And I call this the phylogenetic tree problem. You guys have all seen phylogenetic trees. And in fact, early on in this presentation, I showed you an old phylogenetic tree from Darwin's day that showed this kind of branching, where you have all these different species coming from some original species. So that's a phylogenetic tree. Well, the phylogenetic tree for humans, the simplified version of it, says that there was a common ancestor down here that was shared by orangutans, chimps, and humans. As time proceeded, orangutans branched off and developed into the orangutans we know now. Okay. So right here, there was a common ancestor shared by humans, orangutans, and chimps. Okay? This is a common ancestor here. And orangutans branched off and formed their own species. Then, at a later point in time, humans and chimps diverged from one another. And they had a common ancestor there. Here's humans, and here's chimps. Okay. So that's what the classic phylogenetic tree looks like for humans. The problem is, now that we have the whole genome of humans and chimps and orangutans, they've been able to use a sequence of more than one gene. Okay, and if you have, if your evolutionary tree is correct, if the theory of evolution is correct, you should really only get one tree. You should get one picture of how these species diverge from one another. Well, that's not what's happening. The latest evolutionary trees have, chimps would come off first, so here would be chimps, and then later humans and orangutans would diverge from one another. What they found, that's orangutans. Okay. So what they found is that 23% of the genes in humans look more like we are more closely related to orangutans than we are to chimps. Okay? And this should not be. Look at all the distance between these. And humans had a common ancestor with chimps before we split apart. We're supposed to have retained, 23% of our genes, we're supposed to have retained an orangutan form that the chimps somehow lost. How did the chimps lose 23% of their genome? You know, why? What explains this massive change in chimps compared to humans? When in fact we all hear all the time that humans and chimps are only separated by a 1.5% difference in the first place. So there's no way to explain what's occurring in these trees. Okay? And in fact, I have a quote from the authors of one of the recent papers that I read on this. And he says, thus, in two-thirds of the cases, a genealogy results in which humans and chimpanzees are not each other's closest genetic relatives. The corresponding genealogies are incongruent with the species tree. In concordance with the experimental evidences, this implies that there is no such thing as a unique evolutionary history of the human genome. That is as close to a critique of the theory of evolution I've ever seen in the scientific literature. Rather, it resembles a patchwork of individual regions following their own genealogy. And this is from this paper called Mapping Human Genetic Ancestry, which occurs in Molecular and Biological Evolution, the Journal of Molecular and Biological Evolution. So you can see here that they acknowledge that these things are occurring. But again, do they falsify the theory of evolution? Do they go back and question? You know what they did? This paper does instead? It uses math to explain away this. It says that either based on the population size here or the amount of time, we didn't get all of our orangutan genes weren't coalesced in the human. That's the word they use for it. So there's a term. And in fact, I'm writing an article that's going into our next copy of our e-zine, Reasons to Believe, our electronic newsletter. You can sign up for that. Fuzz and I both write on this topic. And there's a habit occurring and a pattern occurring in the scientific literature where there are these problems with the theory of evolution, and they name the problem. And once they name the problem, they never go back and tackle the issue. Everybody just uses the phrase that they devised to explain that what's occurring, and then they don't really ever deal with it. So the term that they use for this is called failure to coalesce. And they're very sophisticated terms. Failure to coalesce, or it's also called incomplete lineage sorting. You know, I mean, really, I'm serious. Incomplete lineage sorting. Okay. Yeah, okay. So, you know, those are examples of the kinds of phrases you get to deal with the problems in the theory of evolution, but without any real critiquing of the theory itself. Let's see, I think I have one more slide and that's it. Here's another example of a problem in the theory of evolution from the perspective of macroevolution. I think I actually did this talk for you guys here on and talked about this RNA. This is an RNA that's found to be unique in humans. This RNA is a highly conserved RNA among all the mammalian species. Doesn't change from chickens all the way through chimps. No changes. And then suddenly, going from chimps to humans, there are 18 changes. And it's only 118 nucleotides long, and there are not 18 changes. There's something like that. But there's a lot of changes in a very small piece of DNA. And the number, according to the theory of evolution, the number of changes you should see going from humans to from chimps to humans, 0.25 changes. Instead, they have 18. It's like 60-something times the normal rate of evolution. I did the math last time, and I can't remember what I got. But it's extremely accelerated. So they just named this accelerated evolution, and then no one questions it anymore. And it's not as if accelerated evolution only happens in humans. Lots of species have genes that have some kind of, quote-unquote, accelerated rate of evolution. So all of these things are problems with the theory of evolution. It's by no means as straightforward as evolutionists would have you believe. The way they present it in textbooks has no bearing on the reality of the science being done. And if you actually have to read the scientific literature to find the problems. And even scientists in fields outside of evolutionary biology don't know the problems in the theory. Most biochemists do not know the problems in the theory of evolution. So I think that's the end of my presentation, convergence. I did talk about convergence earlier, but convergence should not happen because you have independent occasions of coming to the same evolutionary solution for a problem, with the E. coli coming to the same mutations to solve the problem of the fact that they're in a nutrient-poor solution. You have... there's a typo here, but you have multiple independent origin of echolocation, twice in bats and once in whales. This should not occur according to the theory of evolution. But now if you read scientists who are popularizers of the theory of evolution like Sean Carroll, he's got several New York Times best-selling books, he will say convergence definitely occurs, doesn't explain what you change about the theory of evolution to justify convergence occurring. It's just that the data shows convergence occurring, so now evolutionists say convergence occurs. But they don't go back and explain how they've changed their explanation of what goes on to drive evolution to show why they were wrong then and why they're right now and why they understand better and can explain why convergence occurs. They just say convergence occurs. That's it. And so there's no real critiquing of the theory. So I have to say that, in large part, evolution is not operating as a science right now. It's operating as a philosophy and as a faith. It's sad that our scientists aren't being more critical of the scientific literature and really thinking things through, but it's the state of things right now. So thank you very much, and I'll take questions, but I'm not going to take all of them for you because I've learned. I'm sorry?
Get someone else.
Okay, we'll get someone else first because I gave you an overabundance last time, unless there's no other questions. Mm-hmm.
What has the response been from scientists to that long-term evolutionary experiment, the results of that?
Oh, there's... there's no real reaction to it. I mean, since microevolution is agreed upon, they don't really, you get what you get. But I mean, certainly the evolutionary rates are not high. You don't get a lot of favorable mutations. You don't see any real change, directional change. But whatever they find, that's what the theory of evolution says. It's kind of like that right now. Yeah.
Where do you start? Human-like creatures. What was the were Neanderthals the first human-like? What was the first?
I forgot the name of the hominid that stood erect. Is that what you're talking about? The first one.
Basically, how they all. I mean, was there Cro-Magnon, and then there was
There's a lot more now.
Homo erectus, Homo sapiens.
There's lots of them, and I don't have a deep background in that. That's more paleoanthropology, and the book you need to read is Who Was Adam? It'll have a lot of discussion of that. It's over here. Fuzz, who's our other biochemist, has trained himself in that area. That's not a discipline of biochemistry. That's an anthropology question. So I don't have expertise in that, but it's definitely not Neanderthal. In fact, Neanderthals have been shown to be an evolutionary dead end. They're actually not related to humans. What you would see here is in this evolutionary tree, you would see various hominids coming off, and in fact Neanderthals came off somewhere in here, and they're thought to be a dead end. They didn't lead to humans. They're just a dead end. And there's lots of dead ends. Lots of the hominids are just dead ends.
So God then apparently, when you say who is Adam, whatever, the first our first ancestor, I guess, whatever. I mean, so the theory is that God had
he created a human.
He created
a human.
A human. But then there's millions of species out there.
Oh, yeah.
Did God create the first of all the species?
Oh, yeah. Well, they're not the first of all the species, because speciation is possible. That's a non-controversial form of evolution. But he would have had to create the first bird, for example, the first dog, the first horse. But from there, you can get a lot of different types of horses. So that would occur. That's speciation.
But when you're talking about God like this, you're talking about science, but obviously when you talk about a divine intervention...
Yeah, that's outside the realms of science.
I'm sorry?
That's outside the realm of science.
Right.
So they can't tell you who did it, but when you bring together, for example, astrophysics in with biochemistry and those kinds of things, astrophysics and cosmology tells you that there was a cause for our universe that's outside of our universe. So astrophysics can point you to the fact that there is a divine creator, but science can't fill in any details beyond that. Okay. But at RTB, we have what we call a testable creation model. So we actually make predictions that can be tested experimentally, that they are the predictions that would come out of a belief in creation as opposed to a belief in evolution. Okay. For example, the finding that Neanderthals, prior to having a sequence for the genome of Neanderthals, evolutionists really believed that they were very closely related to us and that they led to us. But in fact, they don't. They're a dead end. Their genetics don't come close to ours.
Now, you said evolutionists are not, they're saying things, but they're not. You're implying basically that they're saying that they're not admitting to being wrong. I mean,
absolutely. I'm definitely saying that.
So if they're not admitting that, are they just saying, well, if we admit it, we're out of a job, we've got to go into some other field? I mean, what?
Well, you have to remember that it's part of their worldview. For many evolutionists, this is about a lot more than the science. This is their own personal belief. If they have to acknowledge there's a God who created them, then they have that God is owed something. He's owed our allegiance. He might have the right to tell us how we should live our life if he created us. And they don't want to do that. There's a moral turmoil. People don't want to acknowledge there's a God.
So they're rationalizing that. I mean, they're wrong. They know they're wrong, but they're rationalizing it and trying to fill
some of it. You have to remember that very few scientists actually study the topic of evolution. Very few. Okay, so most scientists don't really know the details. They don't know the problems in the theory of evolution. But people who are actually origin of life researchers, for example, they should know better. They should know better.
Well, is the, all right, just one. Is the theory of evolution, Darwin's theory of evolution, is that still taught in schools?
Yeah, with some tweaks, but it's still taught, yeah. There's called the modern synthesis of evolution, but it's just a tweak. Okay.
You know, we're about out of time. Maybe one more question.
Yeah.
Okay.
I'll take you. Okay.
Well, it seems like in the bacteria experiment, they could come up with a rate
of evolution.
Right.
Right.
You have to transfer that from 20-minute generations to, you know, wolf to whale. You've got at least a year and a half to create the next generation of wolves.
Yeah.
They've seen the rocks. You know, how many years do they have? Doesn't it fall
apart? Well, I'll tell you what they did. This is what they did instead. Okay. What they did was they took what they knew about. I don't know where I put my marker. Right here. Okay. What they did instead, I mean, that makes sense, but instead what they did was, if you ask the question, if you look at the number of differences genetically that you have to go through to go from a chimp to a human, is there enough time for all those mutations to occur? The answer is yes, by definition, which means it's invalid, it's circular reasoning. What they did was they took chimps, and they looked at humans, and there's essentially 3 million differences in our sequences. About 3 million nucleotides are different. 3 million differences. They took this difference, and they divided by the amount of time that they think elapsed between here, and so that became the evolutionary rate for chimp to human. So by definition, there has to be enough time to get from here to here because they use what actually occurred to determine what the rate of evolution was. So it's circular reasoning. You're using the facts that you collected here to say, we know evolution occurred here. We know this happened. And so the rate at which the rate that we'd have to have to get from here to here is the real rate. Because we know it happened. But it's circular reasoning. It's just circular reasoning.
So, but then the rate that they found in the bacteria, does it come close to that?
I don't know if it comes close to that, but for example, if you look at the human accelerated RNA, in that time period, going from chimps to humans, you should have seen 0.25 changes in that region. Because different regions of the genes, of the DNA, have different rates of evolution. This is a highly conserved region. You know, it didn't change going from chickens to chimps. And so they don't expect it to change, so they have rates to apply to conserved regions. And based on that, the fact that it's a conserved region, you should only have had 1/4 of a nucleotide change. Of course, you can't have 1/4 of a nucleotide change, but you definitely shouldn't have 18, which is why they label it accelerated. Okay? Make sense? Okay. You can stay and ask questions.
This has been really great. We appreciate it.
I love coming. Invite me anytime.
Would you like to close us in a short prayer?
Sure.
Go ahead.
Father, I thank you so much for this church and the openness they've had to be challenged intellectually over the years and to grow in the knowledge of their faith and the ability to defend their faith from an intellectual standpoint. We thank you for everyone here. We pray that those of us in our midst who are doubters will have some light shed on the things they're thinking about, and that for those of us who are your followers, that we will be more confident that we can talk to non-believers and defend our faith. We thank you for your presence with us and for giving us the ability to learn all these things. And we pray that we will use it for your glory. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.
Amen. Got questions? Come on up.
Yeah. I'm sure you've got questions.
I wanted to give you this. This is from Scientific